Professor Kareem Lakhani is a professor at the Harvard Business School in the area of technology and operations management, and specialized in the management of technological innovation and product development in firms and communities. He's worked for General Electric Medical Systems in Canada. He also was part of the Boston Consulting Group, where he's a consultant there. He's awarded his PhD from MIT. He has a master's degree from MIT and a bachelor's degree from the McMaster University School in Canada, and has received many awards and really is an amazing contributor to this area. Please welcome Professor Kareem Lakhani.
You should clap after the session is over, not before. So I get the unenviable task of trying to wrap up 10 sessions. True to the HBS learning model, I'll have very few slides and a lot of conversation and make it all about what you guys learn instead of me telling you what you learn. So we follow the case-based, participant-centered learning model. And I think that's a bit of the theme here anyway. So I will leave my professor hat down very quickly and get into conversation with all of us. The DOTS theme sort of seems to be de rigueur here today. So you can imagine that the 10 workshops, the 9 workshops, were like 10 DOTS. And it's our job collectively here to put it together and make sense of it, and to use your experience in 2 of the conferences, of the workshops together. Before I begin, though, I just want to show you a very different example of knowledge beyond authority. This is from Wikipedia, which is a sustaining puzzle for many scholars, many people both in practice, outside of practice, trying to make sense of how this thing called Wikipedia works. And this article in the New York Times last month is sort of endemic of sort of the people's desire to figure this out. So this came out just after the horrible disaster at Virginia Tech. And here's what the author wrote. Imagine a newspaper with more than 2,000 writers, researchers, and copy editors. Yet no supervisors or managers to speak of, no deadlines, no meetings to plan coverage, no decisions handed down through a chain of command. It doesn't sound like any news operation that any journalist would recognize. Yet that seemingly chaotic non-structure best describes a scene at Wikipedia. Served as the essential news source for hundreds of thousands of people on the internet trying to understand the shootings at Virginia Tech from the contributions of 2,074 editors. At last count, so this is April, the site created a polished, detailed article on the massacre with more than 140 separate footnotes and a timeline of the attacks. You know, 250,000 hits. And even the local newspaper said that the Wikipedia page had emerged as the main source of authority on the shootings. And then it gets even better. So in interviews, some of the most prolific contributors to the article said they were at a loss to explain how everything manages to come out as well. So somebody from Finland writes, as a popular joke goes, the problem with Wikipedia is that it works only in practice, but not in theory, right? And I think many of us are in this world around sort of knowledge beyond authority and the university knowledge beyond authority. I think we are at the edges of practice to a large degree, and we're trying to make sense of it. And there aren't that many theories around. People are trying hard as hell to make sense of it. The work by scholars affiliated with the Berkman Center and around the world are trying to make sense of this thing, trying to build theory around it, but practice is leading the way in many cases. And I think this experiment here is also a similar endeavor, because we're trying to sort of say, if you think about Wikipedia, you know, where's the authority in Wikipedia? Where is the knowledge in Wikipedia? And how do we assert knowledge and assert authority in Wikipedia? And I think these are some of the fundamental questions I think we have ourselves here faced as we went through the workshops. So one of the things I did was sort of take the conference title seriously. So, you know, university and sort of knowledge beyond authority. But if you think about the university, there's a couple of things going on. The university is a source of knowledge, right? We produce knowledge, we create knowledge. We're also consumers of knowledge in universities. So we'll take other sources of knowledge and use them in our own production. Of course, as libraries and as websites, as digital archives, are also a repository of knowledge. So we'll store the knowledge, and the question often is, who are we storing this knowledge for? And I think this will come back to us as we move forward. But we're also transmitters of knowledge as well, right? So we will provide access to some or less degree to this knowledge based on our repositories. And there's always a but, though, right? And the but is the fact that the internet is blurring producers and consumers and transmission and storage of knowledge, right? And it's no wonder that we're sort of discussing this issue here, because the consumption, production, transmission, and storage is all becoming one big mess. And there are now demands on this knowledge that we're all dealing with, from not just within the university, but outside the university. And I think, again, if you look back at the workshops and your experience in them, we sort of put the university as the central place to think about these issues, but it goes beyond universities as well. And then, of course, when we talk about authority, you know, universities to some degree have a monopoly these days over certifying knowledge workers, right? We hand out degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, right? And so that is kind of interesting. So if we're thinking about knowledge beyond authority, and the university is a main found repository, transmitter, creator, consumer of knowledge, but then we also have this authority structure over the knowledge, right? We will say who has qualified to some degree with knowledge. And then also we have authority over the knowledge as well, right? We will say who gets, like, what is knowledge to some degree through the peer review process, through the journals process, and so forth. We actually assert authority over, like, what is in and what is out in terms of knowledge. And also, of course, there's an issue of access, which is who has authority to access this knowledge along the way. So all these issues, I think, are at hand as we were in the workshops. Now, I didn't get a chance to attend all 10. I was only in two. And what I would say is that I think knowledge beyond authority is a challenge to the university, right? It's not going to be kumbaya, it's all about community, and we're all about, you know, hugging each other and talking how great knowledge is. But knowledge is problematic, knowledge is disputed, people fight over being first to create knowledge. And this workshop today, as well as what happened yesterday, is actually sort of at its heart, I think, a challenge to the existing structures around knowledge. So, you know, if you think about the centuries-old dispute between Leibniz and Newton over calculus, like, who invented calculus, right? This was not a happy dispute. You know, there was a lot of bad blood over knowledge and who had the rights on that knowledge and who was first with that knowledge. And these disputes are all around us even today. So, for instance, there's a lot of concern that, you know, John Wilbanks and team from Science Commons is trying to address is the lack of sharing of knowledge in biology and in medicine, where scientists don't want to share. And we thought we were all about sharing knowledge. There's many reasons why universities will lock up in patents all the knowledge that is produced by its professors. So this conference theme and this conference exposition, I think, is a direct challenge to this. And I don't think we'll be able to, you know, with the new president coming in here with the wand, sort of address that and sort of say, okay, now we're going to change our policies and we have a radical change. You know, my perspective is that change is going to be incremental, experimental, right? And we'll see from small steps some creeping view towards this. So, you know, I was at MIT when the Open Courseware Initiative was announced. And the backstory behind this, right, is at least one of the backstories I heard was at the time of the bubble, of the internet bubble, Harvard, you know, Stanford, a bunch of universities established commercial operations to profit from knowledge, right? And they're going to sell courses and so forth online through varieties of commercial companies. MIT was late to the game, right? And in traditional MIT hack mentality, they said, how do we hack this? How do we gain advantage? And they said, well, we'll just create a hack which is unbeatable. We'll just make it free, make it available for free, right? So even there's a competition amongst who has the first rights on knowledge that MIT played this hack and created OpenCourseWare. I think as we think about knowledge beyond authority, but we think about the role of the university, central role of the university with knowledge and in creating authority around knowledge, I think we have a central tension here for us to grapple with and make sense of. What I got from in talking with the moderators of the various workshops was there's the hunger for change. Change X was sort of the theme that came out. We should change this, we should change that. And of course, I can't summarize all the changes. I have created some buckets thanks to my colleagues in my first workshop. And the first set of changes is sort of policy level changes, right? So issues about this broader mission of the university. And what I want to do is open this up. So we'll go through four of these buckets, but in each of the buckets, I want to get your perspectives about what happened in the workshops. So policy level, so there's a broader mission for the university. So, and Terry Fisher earlier this morning had a great synopsis, which was there might be concern that this movement to open up access, to open up the knowledge bases within the university may end up causing a lower performance in the mission of the university to educate its students and create knowledge. So when we open up, when we create a broader mission for the university, right, when you add more people, give more people access, they'll come at a cost, it won't be free. What happens to the overall mission for the university? And with that, along the policy side, this whole notion about sort of copyright and copyleft, right? I mean, I think that is sort of at the central debate here, which is how much access can you provide, and when do we leave a copy behind for others, and when do we create rights around the copies of our work? A lot of concern around clarity on policy. We don't know what fair use really means. We don't really know what, you know, when I excerpt three paragraphs from an HBS press book, is that violating HBS's copyright or not? And then who is responsible? Who's going to drive this change? Where will this change come from? And then policy level changes at the public side, at the private side, and also the nonprofit side. So I just want to open up the discussion here and get your perspectives on, from your point of view, in the workshop, what were the policy type issues that came up and how would you grapple with them? Now we have another great tradition at HBS, which I think also happens here, which is the cold call. So should I cold call maybe, Professor? Yeah? who was in the open courseware? I can't see a hand, sorry. So maybe the open courseware folks can sort of talk about policy level. Oh, right back here, okay. Thanks, Emma. Yep.
My name's Anne Margulies, I'm from MIT's open courseware project. I think a little bit what we talked about in the workshop was one of the great surprises to MIT was, first of all, that it has not diminished the brand at all. If anything, it's enhanced the brand.
Yeah.
But even more surprising were all of the very subtle benefits, but cumulatively very significant benefits back to MIT and to the education on campus at MIT.
Okay.
So through the workshop, we went through many of the examples of how opening access to the world also opened access to MIT. So many of the walls and the barriers between MIT departments, all those silos started to come down as MIT faculty could see what their colleagues were teaching. MIT students can explore subjects in areas that they don't even major in. And it's become really a tool that is used significantly by the entire community.
Yeah. Do you think it's broadened the scope of the mission for MIT?
Well, yeah, MIT is an extraordinary place, I have to say. I've only been there 6 years, but I've been 5 years. I've been there 5 years, but MIT has an extraordinarily strong public service mission. The university's mission, in short, is to advance education and to serve the world. Its very engineering-driven culture means that MIT thinks about big problems and then acts in very big ways to solve big problems. So I noticed you mentioned that you anticipated taking small incremental steps. That's just not the MIT way. Yeah. MIT takes sort of big, bold steps, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
But certainly, OpenCourseWare is consistent with the MIT mission historically. And if you were to ask the MIT president now, Susan Hockfield, she sometimes describes OpenCourseWare as now MIT's largest international collaboration. Mm-hmm. So where it's really expanded MIT's mission is in how we relate more globally.
Yeah. So why wouldn't Harvard do this?
Why wouldn't Harvard do this?
Yeah. I mean, if it's so blindingly obvious, we're two subway stops away. I mean, you've talked to some colleagues here, right?
It wasn't obvious before, it was only obvious after.
It wasn't obvious before? It wasn't?
Okay. You know, this is just my opinion. I think the reason this was able to happen at MIT is because MIT really, first of all, the idea came from the faculty, and MIT genuinely has a unitary faculty and a way for the faculty to come together to debate things as a whole.
Yeah.
And they went through a very careful process for a year. After the MIT faculty came up with the idea, they spent a year debating it internally until the entire faculty said, yep, it's the right thing to do. So it's that part of the MIT culture. And then the extraordinary thing was that the leadership embraced it immediately and made it happen. So that, I think that's what it took.
If it's a policy level change, which to some degree it is, right? I mean, although it's consistent with the mission, it's still, you know, a major shift in terms of how you project outwards now, all of a sudden. What do you tell other people in terms of this kind of a radical change in delivery? So if other universities that are here or other institutions want to embrace this level of openness with this core mission, what do you tell them? How should they go about doing it?
Well, I don't really have an elevator speech for that,
okay.
Except that it's sort of happening. I mean, part of what, I'll pose more of a question than an answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, there are now over 150 universities around the world who are developing their own OpenCourseWare sites, but it's largely happening internationally. About a dozen schools in the United States are developing OpenCourseWare. So I don't know the answer, but there's a question there as to what is it about higher education in the United States that creates more barriers and obstacles to embracing OpenCourseWare or open access in general?
Yeah. Any thoughts on that question? Oh, back there. If you just introduce yourself as well.
Sure.
I'm Jason from UMass Boston, and I guess for a school like ours, it would be hard to do open courseware because, right, but not at the level you are. I mean, a little one, because they need to sell online services as well as, you know, distance learning and stuff to make money, right, because it's so broke. So that, I would say, is a barrier for a lot of schools. There isn't as much largesse available to allow that kind of, you know, munificent behavior, I guess. So that's my quick comment.
There's another comment at the back. That was the same comment? Okay.
Yeah, Harvard could do it, sure. Okay.
Okay.
Many small universities would choose to put the money in something else.
In something else. And why would that be? Just because it's not...
The return on the investment. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, the university wouldn't see the return on the investment in terms of its international prominence and offering free content to everybody in the world compared to putting the money in some other program that right. might generate tuition.
But Anne hinted at the fact that it actually has enhanced learning within the campus. And so you don't think there's an argument to be made about that we can actually have better learning experience on campus by being out there as well?
Well, that's a sale that would have to be made by the instructional technology people, right, who are helping build course websites or do PowerPoints or find videos. And they're not yet making that sale or trying to make that sale, I guess, for some reason that they don't see the outside benefit in terms of the return on what they're providing either. So.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about the other striking debate here around there's a workshop on the Record Industry Association and the university, and this concern around policy as well, I think also related with that is sort of the moral mission of the university. So I just want to get a sense about policy from that workshop, policy issues that were laid out from that workshop. Zach? Sure. Yeah, right behind you.
So
Zach Greent from Mozilla Foundation. Yeah.
Thank you. So while people mull over the suitably restrained comments on the other discussion, how is something like OpenCourseWare really that different from Publish or Perish, which has been a part of universities for a good amount of time? Putting out useful material for other people to study, it seems to be a very natural continuation. Why do people see it as something different? I've never really understood that, but I'm not an academic.
Response to Zach? Zach, do you have an answer yourself? Just tradition? You just don't do it that way? Okay. Right. 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 So Rhea, who's the Rhea? I mean, I can just find Doc.
I'm suppressing a sneeze.
Oh, okay.
But you just succeeded.
That works.
In doing that, yes. Okay, so I won't sneeze into the microphone. It was a contentious session. And,
okay,
and
but nobody's speaking up. What's going on?
Yeah.
Did you just shut them all up, or?
No. Unfortunately, the RIAA itself was not there.
Sure.
So we imposed on Alec French to absorb most of the opprobrium coming from everybody else. But he did a very good job of expanding on what the content holders and the creative community, as they put it, want out of the university. And I think we had very little agreement. I think that the universities, the schools, would rather not be told what to do. I think that's what it kind of comes down to. I think there was general agreement around the moral issues. I don't think anybody defended or wanted to defend the illegal downloading or uploading of copyrighted works. On the other hand, the universities did not want to be in a position of policing, as it were, students on the matter. So, and that's my sort of takeaway from it. But I see Lewis has got, may not be thinking the same thing, and Wendy as well. So I'd like to pass it off to them to say whatever they're going to say.
Sure. The policy issue at the kernel of that debate came down to, even among a general agreement that copyright infringement was a bad thing, should the university be in the position, because it's the ISP, of enforcing copyright law against its students? And we heard from most in the university community that that was not the proper role for the university, that it was putting other forces, market forces, and particular interests above their interests in educating students, interfering with students' academic exploration, to be asked to impose kind of technical speech filters on academic networks. And so while copyright infringement is a problem, it's a problem primarily for the copyright holders to deal with, not to, you know, pull others into the enforcement problem.
So, but you think the universities are being a bit two-faced about this? Because I'll just, you know, put on my business school hat, which is like, you know, if there's an IP infringement of university property, right, universities will sue till the cows come home, right? Will stop, you know, especially we've seen some incidences in the pharmaceutical business and so forth, and we'll really go after the infringers, right? And so I wonder if on the one hand, when the university property is being infringed on, you know, we don't sort of take this market force-based approach to an answer, to a solution, right? But when somebody else's property, you know, property writ large, and we can sort of debate the types of property that is, you know, we're sort of being, well, it's kind of okay.
I think the argument wasn't that they couldn't try to enforce their copyright claims, but that they shouldn't pull the university in and sort of divert the university's attentions into that fight.
Right.
So when the university goes out and enforces a patent right, the effect of that is primarily against the person who infringed the patent, not against others who happen to be nearby. Whereas dragooning the university into RIAA's copyright battle affects the educational experience of all the students at that university, making them less able to do all sorts of things other than infringe copyrights.
Gotcha.
That's a bleeding problem, a collateral harm problem.
Okay. There's a comment back there, then here, and then there. If you just introduce yourself as well.
Sure. I'm Sam Halpert. I work for the Harvard Extension School on distance education, and I just had a quick comment to that, which is that the role of the university may not be as an ISP necessarily, but with respect to undergraduates, as an institution whose role is to teach ethics to upcoming generations. That's not necessarily an argument that I, you know, would back all the way, but I think it's worth considering. That there might be an ethical responsibility, if not an official responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, students, you know, we have conduct review boards, and students get expelled for lying, cheating, plagiarism, and so forth. And, you know, I mean, there may be a legitimate argument about this to be had.
I'd like to raise a question about the assumptions behind the whole topic here, and that is that somehow the universities have some inherent authority with regard to knowledge. I think when we're seeing Wikipedia and other things, that it would be a mistake for us to assume that somehow or that is always going to be that way. And I would have preferred to title something about knowledge expanding authority rather than going beyond authority, because I think what is happening in the internet and in the open learning process is that the whole concept of what is authoritative knowledge is being changed.
Yeah.
And the university needs to adapt to that, or it will find itself in deep trouble.
Yeah. So how would you, what does the university need to do to adapt to it? So we can say we need to adapt, but what do I tell, you know, the dean of the law school, right? What do you need to do?
Well, I guess my assumption would be that we need a different frame about the source of power. and that this applies not simply to knowledge, but it certainly applies to knowledge, that we need to see the authority of knowledge to be more based upon the user than upon the source, and that it's less hierarchical and more flat, if you will.
Okay.
That the ultimate authority, the ultimate verification of knowledge is how it is used in practice. And that is not necessarily something that is decided at the top.
So how many people are from universities here? Raise your hands high, please. How many people from universities, affiliated with universities? Okay, how many people have PhDs? Okay, so all you that have PhDs, proposal maybe, if I can expand, is like, you know, maybe the expertise you've built up is up for question. Anybody want to agree with that? Push back against that? Agree? Hands up. Those with PhDs that agree? David. David's going to be speaking again soon anyway. But.
I wasn't raising my hand to speak. You sandbagged me. I was just agreeing with the guy. The PhD obviously signifies that some amount of work and competency has gone in, but
yeah.
Knowledge is no longer a masterable field, so I have no sense of mastery in my area, and am far. So let me put it like this, ending a conversation by saying, well, I have a PhD, never worked, and it really doesn't work now.
Yeah, right. Good. And somebody have a counter, so if, but then why are we investing, why have this vestige of PhD programs in which you spend thousands and thousands of dollars and, you know, master's programs, and so why, I mean, if we take your argument to the limit, right, we shouldn't have formal degree programs, we shouldn't, I mean, what do you think? I mean, is that what you're asking for, or am I missing the boat completely?
Well, I'll speak my own view of this, that the primary function of most professions has been to exclude, to prevent others from doing what they do. Mm-hmm. And if they're really successful, they make it illegal and put you in jail if you do what they do, all right? And so if you take that assumption, then if we're really talking about a knowledge-based society, all right, and opening knowledge to a broader range of people so that more and more people have more and more knowledge, then you're talking about a restructuring of power. And that's an uncomfortable thing for those who have power to do.
Yeah. John Wilbanks?
So I think one of the dangers here is, John Wilbanks, Science Commons. One of the dangers is treating sort of all scholarship as the same. So it's one thing to have citizen studies of history in which there are revisionist ideas. It's another thing to say we're going to do revisionist chemistry and put acids and bases together. So I think it's important to say, I mean, in some of these cases, the guilds are successful because it's a very efficient way to teach the canon of knowledge. So it's important to be, so one of the lessons I took out of all of this was that it's heterogeneous, right? Scholarship isn't scholarship isn't scholarship. Funders aren't funders aren't funders. Everything is heterogeneous. And so it's very dangerous. We've had to blur the heterogeneity into this and make it look homogenous to discuss it at this level that we've been doing it. But when we implement, we have to be as careful to think about the details as possible. And what I've heard throughout this is that different people have leverage. Different stakeholders have different amounts of leverage. Funders have leverage over fundees. Universities have leverage over faculty and students. Publishers have leverage over content. And everyone wants someone else to shift that leverage in a way that is uncomfortable and new. And the only people who don't seem to have leverage are the students.
So John, if we could just stay with you for a second, I mean, I think one of the things you're doing in your work is around technology, right? Enabling sort of the science commons to emerge. Can you sort of reflect on the workshops you attended and sort of the technological, this desire for technological changes that came through and, you know, realistic, not realistic, utopian, possible?
Well, I mean, I'm a utopian, so I'm probably the wrong one to reflect on that. I heard a lot about Web 2.0 and semantic web, And I'm, you know, I've staked my career on the semantic web, so I'm going to cheer it as much as anybody. I didn't hear a lot of the reality of the infrastructure that's going to take for the semantic web to come about. It's much more complicated than the regular web to come about. It's discipline specific. It requires knowledge networks, not just physical wired networks, to emerge. But I heard enough. It was nice to sort of hear the excitement about it. But because these are knowledge networks, they are built on open content. And what I believe and what I heard in some other places is that it's when these waves hit, when the infrastructure is in place, which may be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, there will be a natural evolutionary advantage for the open approach in that world. And it will become an adapt or die environment at that point. But the depressing thing is to get to the phase changes and to the sort of disruptive changes, there's a lot of really boring plumbing to do between here and there. And that's the technical plumbing which we work on, and then the policy changes are things like mandating open content so that we can build plumbing out of it. And so I'm afraid it's not exciting. It's, you know, we need to do plumbing and we need to have open content on which to do the plumbing.
All right, and is the plumbing, where do you think the plumbing is right now?
It's a long way from moving into the house.
Okay.
You know, and libraries are going to be the repository for a lot of the plumbing. Libraries are going to do things like store copies of things for 50 years.
Right.
Keep persistent naming systems for 50 years so that if we build a query into the architecture of the semantic web, it says find me drug targets for Alzheimer's, that query runs in 20 years. You know, one of the best quotes was that 20 years ago we thought microfiche was the storage technology of the future. You know, I mean, we may well, and we probably are wrong about semantic web, but something's going to come along in 20 years, and if the content's open, we can use it. If the content's not, if we've only gotten permission to use it for semantic web, then we're going to be in just the same position we are today.
Yeah. So if the library becomes an R&D, an engineering shop, I mean, that's what you're sort of implying. Right? That to some degree, libraries have to do basic R&D on engineering, on...
My argument is that libraries are infrastructure. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
Libraries are infrastructure for R&D and knowledge and this kind of media.
But you need R&D for the infrastructure as well, right? You need to create that infrastructure. So how many libraries are prepared to go in the direction that John is talking about? Like, how many of you are ready to take on this challenge of creating new technologies, new approaches beyond microfiche? Microfiche is 50 years, right? How long? Okay, beyond microfiche for us. So what do the librarians here think? And Anne Wolpert can't answer because she already has an R&D house. MIT doesn't count. Anybody else? Yes.
I've been working with structured documentation for 24 years, I guess, and I think it's an inevitability. I've been preaching it for all that time, and librarians really have to take the lead. And I think there's a lot more stuff out there that's usable right now than most people realize. It's all piecemeal, and if you want to put it together, it's going to be building a roadmap, deciding what pieces of the puzzle fit in the roadmap and where we need to add additional tools. And I think it could actually be pasted together much faster than people realize. XML-based software, XML and SGML-based tools are the way to go with it.
But do you think that the libraries are ready for this technological challenge, or will they rely on external vendors to, you know, do it for them? I mean, what do you think?
If we rely on professional vendors to do it for us, it's not going to happen.
Why?
Because their purpose is different. The vendors are their clients first and foremost are the content owners and the content corrallers, the people that sequester the information. Then secondarily, maybe the librarian, and they pay little or no attention at all to the user, the patron.
So then they have to do it themselves.
We have to take the lead in defining the standards, making sure that anything that we use at least supports an open standard. It doesn't necessarily have to be exclusively open, but it's got to support a pathway to building a global distributed database.
Right, right. Comment back there.
I'll just add one comment. I work in the Harvard University Library, the Office of Information Systems, and I think it depends on how you look at the question as to what the library is. If you look at something like Google or the vendors as a discovery mechanism and providing the user interface and much of the entry point, and the library, for example, a Harvard library, providing a repository for the information that's local to Harvard, but not to all the information in the world, and providing those standards and interfaces so that the entire internet can operate as a single library.
Right.
But Harvard contributing its components. So I think the answer to the question is that the libraries, as they're currently conceived, don't have the whole answer. They just have a piece.
Yeah, yeah. What about this notion that I heard also in some of the workshop was that as part of this mission of the libraries to open up, right? So one is libraries used to be around bringing knowledge in, and now it's about bringing knowledge out. What about the question is, a lot of people sort of talked about the technological infrastructure of the university also needs to be opened up. So that we, beyond, again, students and faculty and staff accessing technologies, we want to actually open up the infrastructure for other local communities or anybody in the world. And I just wanted to get a perspective here about that. I mean, is that, again, part and parcel of this knowledge beyond authority conversation, or is that just sort of, you know, we're trying to be nice to everybody, so we should open up access? Any thoughts? No thoughts? Oh, SJ. SJ is from OLPC, so, and he's got one working there, yeah?
I think there's another one on the other side of the room.
Oh, okay.
So, there are two things I wanted to say about technological changes, and one of them is as much an answer to your previous question, looking for someone to defend the role of university programs. And as a Wikipedian, and as someone who doesn't have a PhD, but who thinks that these programs are extremely valuable, I'll just put in my two cents. And I think that as information becomes more open, and as we open up these technologies and the infrastructure and the whole process of producing the knowledge that people share, and then the process of qualifying it and saying, here's what really matters, here's what makes a fantastic course that qualifies you to be a professional doctor, a professional lawyer. As we open that up, we'll both get input from people who wouldn't be accepted in the halls of discussion about how to structure a course, and you'll get input from some really great people who have said, oh, that's boring, and I wouldn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, but they sit in their small corners, and they produce fantastic work, and every now and then they issue a manuscript, and people say, it's fabulous, we hadn't heard from this person in 20 years, here's their latest work, and simply by demonstration, they can see that there's something wonderful there. Many of those people don't get involved in education, or what we consider a formal degree process, but as you develop this overwhelming collection of knowledge, having channels that exist to draw you through it for people who want that kind of explicit support, and having institutions that are dedicated to building the best way to learn everything there is to know about a field such as chemistry is extremely valuable. These won't be the only ways to get a world-class education. Right now, you can get a world-class education with no degrees, but they will both be building blocks for anyone who wants to compare what they're doing to what the rest of the world is doing, and they'll be the way that most would-be students aspire to learn. The technological changes are definitely not just, here's what we have, let's make it open and available to other people. They're very much about building the communities that it hasn't been possible to learn from. And for technological reasons, I think the more important problem is that historically it hasn't been feasible. The transaction costs have been so high that you couldn't ask other people who were far away from you to just contribute two or three lines about what they care about. And they had to be both relevant enough to what you're doing and clever enough that you wanted to spend a long time with them, get them involved in a long conversation. The ability to pick up on this long tail of expertise and passion and enthusiasm really benefits students and teachers in any organization. So I don't think anyone should see this as an effort to give a little bit back to people who don't have much.
So you're making the same argument as OCW was, which is like there's a tremendous benefit back into the community by opening up.
Yes.
Okay. So I think the next side is sort of this hunger for economic changes. And I think this came to head a lot, I think, in the discussion I was at in the morning, which is about, you know, the publishers of journals versus everybody else. And the question of business models, right? Business models for both universities as well as for the publishers. And I think there's an inherent tension that we can't seem to get around, which is that the academy today relies heavily on commercial providers to help fulfill its knowledge mission. Right? But the interests of the commercial providers are to limit access and to charge for access. And it seems to me that we were in the conversation and the workshop, we're sort of going over each other a lot. And I wanted to sort of say, who's going to win? Do you want to think about that? You were the head of the workshop, so.
So I think it's fair to say that there wasn't a consensus that arose during that workshop about the right way that this information dissemination should take place. At the moment, of course, there are many different models being pursued, and that's probably the right approach, and we'll just kind of experiment a while and see how things go. But it certainly seems like there's room for new approaches because the underlying mechanisms have changed since 50 years ago when commercial publishing really took off as the underlying provider of mechanism for scholarly publishing. Who's going to win? I don't know. I'd prefer not to think of it as winners and losers.
Yeah.
But the important thing is to keep the goal in mind, and the goal is the dissemination of knowledge. The goal is not maintenance of any particular stakeholder's claim in the.
Right, but we know from business history that most organizations are wedded to one business model, and then they die if that business model expires. And so I just wonder. Is this one of just waiting it out and letting the other institutions emerge, like PLOS and so forth, or is there a conversation about
businesses don't die because we just wait it out. Businesses die because other things go on.
Sure.
While some people are waiting, but other people aren't waiting. And so, and there are a lot of people who aren't waiting and they're trying different things. No one's waiting. I think everybody is changing, including publishers. They're aware, like everybody else, what's going on.
Any of the representatives from the publishing houses, any thoughts on this topic in terms of changing business models for the publishers and your interactions with universities who may be forcing you to some degree to change your licensing agreements and so forth? We won't bite, I promise.
Prominence in your question.
Say more. It's in the economic bucket, but
I'm out of education, public school education.
Yeah.
And everybody says education ought to pursue the business model for running the schools. And I've seen it tried. I haven't seen it improve anything yet.
Yeah.
The other thing is, any discussion we have for today, for example, I was in the digital divide.
Yeah.
And the elephant in the room that limited the conversation
yes.
was profit.
Mm-hmm.
There's an assumption, it seems to me, that there's something primary and supreme about business, at least in the United States, that must be assumed to be given prominence in and deference in any discussion about how to effect change.
Yeah. That's yeah. So I don't know if I mean you know we've covered policy. I think in the economic side there's a question I think in the end about how do we pay for all this stuff, right? So you know Wikipedia does appeals for its donors to you know. Wikipedia is not free in the sense there's bandwidth and there's servers and so forth, and they go to their donors and they appeal for money, right? And so we do need some way to feed people who are going to be contributing all this great stuff. Now, some people profit from it, and the question is, you know, that we've had a system of knowledge production with the university where there's been a very active and important role for the commercial entities, and the universities often get measured on how much commercial entities they produce as well. So I'm just saying that can't go away, that we can't just sort of wish it away and sort of say, forget about it. That's part and parcel of this knowledge debate we're having. Comment back there?
This complements the question about economic changes, but Benkler's thesis, the Yale Law professor's thesis, is that there's a whole new sphere of non-market information production that emerges as a consequence of very, very low-cost computing, and that this sphere is fairly extensive. The MIT OpenCourseWare project is one, Wikipedia is another, and they go on and on and on.
Wait a second. How much did you get from the Mellon Foundation for OCW or Sloan Foundation? Yeah, do you know? Is it public? Can you say $24 million from foundation money? So this was not free at all, right? I mean, this cost money to make.
There are, I suppose, other examples that are quite numerous that are very low cost, based on a low cost model. So perhaps you're questioning Benkler's thesis that there is a sphere of non-market information production. Given that there might be, and that this complements market production of information, and this sphere indeed focuses on information itself and is therefore somehow novel relative to the market.
Yeah.
Will there be new emerging forms of, for example, degrees in the university model where, due to this information sphere, non-market, we have access to knowledge which is credentialed.
What do you think?
I think it's potentially likely. I think we have to wait and see.
Okay. And what would cause that to emerge, do you think?
I think it's an ongoing series of innovations that emerge out of this whole serendipitous process of the development of the network society that started with the semiconductor in the 50s.
Okay. Okay. SJ is in it. Yeah. And I haven't been on this side of the room much, so I'm going to hang out here now and talk to you guys.
Just a quick comment. It's true that projects like OCW may have cost a fair amount to start, but there are a lot of people who would be willing to pay a small amount for information and material that they are looking for. And the ability to get rid of those transaction costs and connect people directly, connect small individual contributors to small creators, is extremely powerful. And I think that there are many more people who want to create and who would be glad to give of their time and of their money to be able to create. And the trick is just to connect those people who are often very capable in some ways with people who are waiting for this result to come about.
Right.
And while it's true that Wikipedia, for instance, asks for donations, they don't go to donors. They go to the readers of the site.
Sure.
And that's probably a good example of very low cost per page of production. maybe that's $2 million over the history of the project for 20 million pages of edited material.
Right.
So, and most of that cost didn't go to people. It went to infrastructure that theoretically could be done away with a more efficient system for sharing knowledge of all kinds. Right. So somehow making those connections will be a very important shift.
So I have 5 minutes. Sorry, did you want to say? Yeah.
Just let me say that about OCW, we've been thinking about it. There are all these effects which are productive, and they're presumably all around the world, and they're conceivably measurable in economic terms, and I think it's probably very likely that they vastly exceed $24 million.
Yeah.
So this is a great deal in this case, and so we're really working on how do we restructure things to make these sorts of things easier to make.
Yeah, my sense is that I don't think it's a free lunch, that it requires investment of time, effort, you know, and dollars, and that